This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Today we're going to be talking to Emily Petroff from Swinburne Uni of Technology in Melbourne. Thank you for joining us on Jodcast.
Thanks, it's good to be here.
So you've been visiting Jodrell Bank to give a few talks, but before that, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a PhD student at the moment. So I'm about 2.5 years into my PhD, and I'm based in Melbourne, Australia, and I mainly study things like pulsars and radio transients and use the Parkes radio telescope. So I'm just coming to Jodrell and to various places in Europe to talk a bit about the work that I do and hear about all the exciting stuff that's happening here.
You've been to a lot of places recently. From your Twitter, it says you've been in Dubai a lot. So where have you been going?
Yeah, so I've been kind of traveling all over the place recently. I was in the Netherlands at Astron in March. And on this trip in particular, I'm going to Oxford here in Manchester. I'll be in Bonn. I'll be in Amsterdam as well as Astron, and then back to Bonn for a little while. So yeah, all over the place.
You were here giving a talk. Could you give us a little rundown of what that was?
Yeah, so I was talking about fast radio bursts. And these fast radio bursts, well, we don't know exactly what they are, but we think that they're these very powerful, very short-lived explosions that are happening in galaxies about halfway across the universe. So my research focuses on trying to find fast radio bursts, since we only know of about a handful of them at the moment, and trying to figure out where they're coming from and what could potentially be causing such incredibly violent events in other galaxies.
If these things are so bright, how come we've only just sort of started finding them? How come there are so few?
Yeah, that's a good question. So up until recently, people didn't even think to look for them. So we have these surveys that look for pulsars in our own galaxy, but we only searched a fraction of the parameter space. And so now that computers have gotten much faster, you're able to search much more of that parameter space, and it's not so expensive. It takes less time than it would have in the past. So people have started kind of pushing the boundaries of where we're looking, and in looking out to further and further distances, these fast radio bursts popped up. And so it wasn't until recently, as people sort of re-examined old data, that they started finding them, and now we're finding more and more.
What is it that makes us think they come from other galaxies? How do we know?
Yeah, so for pulsars, we observe, with their radio emission, we observe something called a dispersion measure. And what that is that as the radio light travels from the pulsar to Earth, it goes through the interstellar medium, which is full of electrons. At different wavelengths, the light gets slowed down by a different amount, having traveled through all these electrons. And so we measure the dispersion. So that's just the time delay at different frequencies. And so for pulsars, we have a rough idea of how many electrons are in the interstellar medium, so we can kind of relate that to distance. But for these fast radio bursts, or FRBs, we're seeing that they've traveled through many, many more electrons than we can explain with our own galaxy. So the only way that you would get those extra electrons is if the burst had not only just traveled through our galaxy, but also had traveled through the intergalactic medium, so the space between galaxies.
And even through the galaxy of the host.
That's right, yeah. So there's three components there. And we still don't really know how much of it is from the host and how much of it is from the intergalactic medium, but we do know that they have to be coming from far away and outside of our own galaxy.
And are there any theories on what they could possibly be?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, we don't have a lot of information, so it's all just theories. It has to be something extremely energetic and very, very short. So these fast radio bursts only last about a millisecond. So my favorite stat is a millisecond is about 100 times faster than the blink of a human eye. So these things are really, really quick. And so you need something that is able to produce a lot of energy in a millisecond. So we're talking explosions, flares, collisions, something very, very extreme, potentially involving the densest things in the universe, so things like neutron stars and black holes. So potentially like the collapse of a neutron star or the collision of two neutron stars in another galaxy.
But we won't know until we find a lot more of them.
That's right, yes. So it's still very early days, and we're getting closer to figuring out where they're coming from, but we're not there yet.
So how long do you think it will take for us to find a lot?
It depends. I mean, more and more telescopes around the world are looking for these things. At the moment, the majority have been found at the Parkes Radio Telescope in Australia, but there's one of them that's been reported from the Arecibo Telescope in Puerto Rico, and more surveys are coming online at Jodrell, at Effelsberg, at various radio telescopes all around the world that are going to be looking for these fast radio bursts. So I think more and more will start to appear as more people look.
Yeah, so I've read a lot about this. What is it that makes Parkes so good at finding them? Why is it the FRB machine?
It is, in a lot of ways, it's very, very good for FRBs, partially because it spends so much time looking. So We think that they happen between 5 and 10,000 FRBs over the whole sky every day. But to be able to catch all of those FRBs, you need to be looking at the sky for a long period of time. So Parkes gives a lot of its time to pulsar projects, and pulsar projects observe in a way that makes it very easy to find fast radio bursts in the data. The other reason is that Parkes is very powerful. So it's a giant dish, 64 meters across. It's very sensitive. So you need a good combination of sensitivity and time on sky and a large field of view, because Parkes looks at a large patch of sky at once. So it's just kind of like the sweet spot of all the combination to make it a really good FRB machine.
So you've been finding lots and lots of them. And what is it that we could learn from them? What can we actually do with them, apart from finding out maybe what they are?
Yeah, so they're interesting for a lot of reasons. First of all, because, like I mentioned, to produce something like this, you need an extremely energetic and extremely powerful event. So potentially we're talking about something that's at the edge of extreme physics, where the event that produces these bursts could be some type of new physical phenomenon that we've never really studied before, or it could be probing a physical regime that's just so extreme that we can't study it in our own laboratories. They're also interesting because, as I mentioned, the burst travels through all of the electrons between the host and our telescope. So we actually have a way to measure the electrons in the intergalactic medium, which is something that's never been done before. So you could potentially, if you know the distance to the host galaxy, you could actually weigh the universe. You could be weighing all of the electrons in the intergalactic medium. So that has very interesting implications for how the universe evolved and what it's made of.
Awesome. So lots of cosmologists are sitting there rubbing their hands with glee.
Absolutely. Everybody's getting very excited about these things.
Yeah. And recently, you've done some interesting research of your own at Parkes. Our listeners will have heard a little bit about Heratons. So could you tell us a little bit about that story? It's a funny one.
Yeah, so if you're not familiar with Heratons already, they're this kind of mystery signal that we were picking up at Parkes that kind of mimic the signal that we expect for a pulsar or a fast radio burst. But instead of seeing them in just a single beam in our telescope, because it looks at multiple beams on the sky at once, instead of seeing it in a single beam like you would for an astrophysical object, it was showing up in all 13 beams at once, which hints to something happening locally. But nobody really knew what locally could be causing something that mimics a pulsar or a fast radio burst. And earlier this year in January, we started processing our data much faster. So we're looking through all of the data products, you know, in the day after observations. And we noticed a few of these Heratons that all happened in 1 week. So we started asking the staff on site, well, was anything weird happening that week? They said, no, it wasn't. But they reminded us that in December of last year, they had installed a new RFI monitor on site. So this was something that was meant to monitor the sort of radio interference environment at Parkes. So we went back and looked at the monitor data. And we saw that at the exact times of the Heratons, we also saw this burst of emission happening at a frequency that we weren't observing at.
And these times, they were quite suspicious times of day as well, weren't they?
That's right. So all of the Heratons, both the archival ones and the new ones, all happen around midday. So they...
Lunchtime.
That's right. So we actually found out that these things are coming from the Parkes microwaves. So you can produce a Heraton if you have a direct line of sight between the microwave and the telescope receiver. And instead of waiting for the microwave to finish, you open the door of the microwave to finish your microwave cycle. And this produces a Heraton that we can see with our telescope.
And people all over the place have been testing this out. I know they've been doing it at Jodrell Bank as well.
Yeah, that's been fun this week. I've seen some very, very interesting videos that they've been producing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's actually quite cool. They're starting to test antennas near the microwaves and stuff like that. So,
are they on YouTube?
Not yet, but hopefully they'll be coming out. Yeah.
Yeah. So what can people do to avoid this happening, apart from being patient and waiting for your lunch?
Well, I think patience is a virtue. It's difficult to keep on top of all the interference that's happening at our telescopes these days, because even if when they were built, the telescopes were in relatively quiet environments, people with cell phones, Wi-Fi, microwaves even, are starting to produce lots of spurious signals. So yeah, it's a bit tough. I guess all we can do is really try to keep our radio quiet zones radio quiet.
And put our microwaves in cages.
That's right.
So you've been giving a few interviews about this sort of thing, haven't you? What has the reaction been from the media? Is it sort of a silly scientist, or is it, oh, we've learned something new?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think in one way it's got a lot of excitement, both from astronomers and non-astronomers, because it is, you know, it's very satisfying to solve a mystery. It's maybe not the mystery we were hoping to solve, since, you know, we still don't know where fast radio bursts are coming from. But, you know, sometimes people are kind of take the tack like, oh, those silly scientists just opening their microwaves all the time. But
so what is the difference between protons and fast radio bursts? Like in signal, obviously, one is made by a microwave and one isn't.
Yeah, so this dispersion measure that I talked about, that's kind of an important property. So for fast radio bursts, it tells us approximately how far away they've come from. But for paratons, it seemed that they all clustered around the same values of this dispersion measure all the time. So that gives us a clue that, you know, they're coming from these microwaves. So I think the main difference is FRBs are still real and still safe. They're not coming from the same place. And that's kind of an important distinction. And we kind of know that because these paratons all have the same dispersion measures. And the FRBs are all very spread out in dispersion measure. So you'd need basically as many microwaves as there are FRBs to produce them. So it's kind of comforting, actually, because up until very recently, there was still this suspicion about the FRBs.
There was a great debate.
Yes.
About whether they were the same things as paratons or not.
That's right. So it was kind of the logic was, how can you trust that FRBs are real if you have these signals in your data that you can't even explain? Mm. So now that we've actually explained them, I think people are much happier. Yes, that's right. I'm definitely relieved. So that's been quite nice.
Yeah. It's my PhD as well.
That's right. They're all on the line.
Could you tell us about the name? Do you know why they're called paratons?
The name paratons came from the idea of Sarah Birks-Bellore, who published the first paper about them. And I think it's from some game or something like that. I think it's a winged deer that has the shadow of a human. So it's like the thing and its shadow are different. Like, it's not what it appears to be.
It's pretending to be something that it's not.
That's yes, right.
We looked it up and we saw this very weird picture. We were like, okay.
Yes.
It's quite cool. Okay, thank you. So where are you off to next once you've finished with JD?
I will be in Bonn next week speaking to the folks at the Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy.
Excellent. How long will you be there for?
Just for a week, and then off to the next stage of my adventure.
In the same talk.
That's right.
That's awesome. Well, thank you very much for finding the time to join us today.
Absolutely. It's been great to be here.